What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh, you and our guests, like Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, just show up with your top five lists every week. But are you aware of what I go through to put a show together?
Of course I am!
Of course you are! Ever thought about my responsibilities?
Oh, Dick, what are you talking about?
Have you ever had a single moment's thought about my responsibilities? Have you ever thought for a single solitary moment about my responsibilities to my employers?
That's Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall from The Shining joining us here at The Overlook for a Film Spotting Sacred Cow discussion of Stanley Kubrick's horror classic is Michael Phillips. Michael, thanks for being here.
All work and no play makes Adam a pretty dull boy.
Indeed it does.
You got it. We'll also count down our top five terrifying movie characters. If you get too scared, Adam, remember, it's just like pictures in a book. It isn't real.
I got it.
All that and more ahead on this Halloween edition of Film Spotting. Film Spotting is presented by FreshBooks, the cloud accounting service for small businesses that saves time and gets you paid faster. Join over 5 million FreshBooks users and try the service free for 30 days of unlimited use at FreshBooks.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about it on Film Spotting.
And by Hover. Hover provides simple, clean domain and email management tools. All their domain names come with Whois privacy, so your personal information isn't publicly available. They also have unlimited domain forwarding and 25 top-level domains. They even have a new no-hold policy for customer service calls, so if you call Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, you will get a live person. They guarantee they won't put you on hold. And Josh, as I mentioned a few weeks ago here on the show, I've used Hover myself. It's very easy. If you're a listener out there that's thinking about starting a blog or a podcast and you need a website, it all starts with a domain name. You can get that now with Hover.com.
Visit Hover today at filmspotting.hover.com. Use offer code FILMSPOTTING and get 10% off. That's filmspotting.hover.com. We thank Hover for their support.
You're listening to Film Spotting's Halloween special with our guest, Michael Phillips. Michael, I have to thank you for coming in costume, by the way. Well done.
I don't want to tell anybody out there what I'm really wearing, but hello, Josh. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Michael.
It is great to have you here. We'll reveal our top five terrifying characters later in the show. We'll also spend a few minutes discussing the new documentary, Room 237, which lays out several theories on hidden meanings in The Shining.
But first, here's Johnny.
Has it ever occurred to you that I have agreed to look after the Overlook Hotel until May the 1st? Does it matter to you at all that the owners have placed their complete confidence and trust in me and that I have signed a letter of agreement, a contract, in which I have accepted that responsibility? Do you have the slightest idea what a moral and ethical principle is, do you?
It's Sacred Cow time again on Film Spotting, when we revisit a film that has something of a cemented reputation and try to look at it with fresh eyes. A week or so in advance of Halloween, we thought it would be a good time to talk about The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's 1980 adaptation of the Stephen King novel. How much does The Shining mess with our heads, Adam and Michael? So much that some 30 years later, a documentary has been made profiling the way fans of the film have been haunted by it over the years. Room 237, which was recently shown at the Chicago International Film Festival, digs into the various interpretations and conspiracy theories that obsessive viewers have come up with in their attempts to explain this deeply disturbing film. I wonder if these theories are in some sense a defense mechanism, a way to process the terror that the movie causes. After all, if it can be reduced to a puzzle that's been solved, The Shining is perhaps less troubling. Michael, the last time you were with us, we learned of your love for Jaws. So I know that great white sharks scare you. I'm not sure how you feel, however, about creepy twin girls, decomposing bodies in bathtubs, or elevators bursting with blood. Did The Shining get to you then in 1980? And does it still have the power to disturb you today?
This is the question. This is the question.
It's the essential question.
Okay, this is the question. It's a film. I honestly, Josh, don't have settled, fixed opinions on a lot of the Kubrick work that postdates 2001, A Space Odyssey. I know the films I absolutely adore of his and seem to get so much out of every new experience with them. They tend to be the period from 1956, The Killing, up through and including 2001. And I'm much more, not ambivalent, because he's too distinctive a filmmaker to provoke ambivalence in a viewer, I think. But I tend to slip around and change my mind depending on how many years have gone by on almost everything he made since then, and up until and including his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. I did love going back to The Shining for this show, because it had been years and years since I saw it, and just to kind of see and remember what that incredible elegance of those Steadicam shots, and that's not a minor issue in this film. It's a major issue, with so much of the film is spent barreling behind Danny on that big wheel, which takes you just seeing the big wheel in action on all through those amazing maze-like corridors of the Overlook Hotel. It's why a lot of the film does feel hypnotic, because it is visually casting a kind of trance. But I also, Josh, do feel that I haven't changed my opinion in one way, in that the common complaint about Nicholson's performance in The Shining, that it goes bughouse too early, and that you see the documentaries and you read a little more about, the dozens and dozens of takes that Kubrick was taking, and he tended to, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he tended to always select the nuttier, more outsized editions of whatever Nicholson was coming up with. I mean, sometimes he would do a line, a scene, or set a tone in a more sympathetic, comforting way, and Kubrick would never choose that take. It was always the crazier one. In the same time, he was always trying to get Shelley Duvall to play it a little less nuts. and the film has a very strange tension, because really it's not a horror film. I don't even know what I think of it, frankly. Again, I just saw it, but
even after seeing it recently,
it is still not a horror film. Yeah. It's a black comedy about a particularly American kind of family that deserves what's happening to them.
Okay. I know, Adam, that it terrifies you, at least in references that you've made on the show. We haven't really dug into it at any point. Is that something that it did for you right away when you first saw it? And when did you first see it? Because 1980, hopefully you were a little young to have seen it then, but I'm assuming this is a terror you've had since your childhood at some point.
Yeah, it is. My parents, I've said this before on the show, they didn't really stop me from watching anything. I had a TV in my bedroom pretty early. I had HBO pretty early. I was lucky. And so they didn't shield me from watching things like The Shining that I shouldn't have been watching. And I saw some of this stuff.
And how old were you then?
I was probably 8 or 9 or 10 when I saw The Shining.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, exactly.
This explains everything.
It does. But I probably never saw the entire film. I just saw parts of it, partly because I was too terrified to watch the entire film. I don't think I actually saw the film in its entirety until I was in college and was going through a little bit of a Kubrick phase, as I think we all went through at some point in our cinematic lives. So this was fun for me to go back and revisit. And in terms of whether or not it still scares me, it didn't this time, thankfully, because I had my wife sitting next to me. So even though we were sitting
moral support
in my basement in the dark, and when those twins come on screen and those strings and that eerie music leaps up on you, I didn't jump out of the couch because my wife was there to protect me. So she kept everything on an even keel, which was great. But I love what you said about the cinematography. I think you can't help but talk about this film without mentioning John Alcott's cinematography and the Steadicam use. They actually got the guy who invented the Steadicam to run the Steadicam on this film. And hypnotic is the right word, but it's not just in terms of what the Steadicam is doing in the movement and how fluid it is. It's also even in, I think, the dialogue scenes, how he calms the camera down in scenes like the meeting with Ullman when he takes the job and is offered the job early in the film. He doesn't do anything really crazy with the camera at all. It settles into this really simple back and forth shot, reverse shot style, the same shots every time that almost lull you to sleep a little bit the same way the Steadicam does. And the deep focus, of course, here is another fascinating part of the film. And they're using these wide lenses to make the characters look so dwarfed inside the Overlook. But then you realize what he's doing in the close-ups, where he deliberately tries to get rid of all the deep focus he can, which is pretty normal with a close-up anyway, but there's no focus at all, so all you can see in these moments is the face. Mm. Those shots that you see in a lot of Kubrick films, that close-up straight on of the face. I love how we get that juxtaposition of all that deep focus and then no deep focus at all, and you just look at the face there. So right from that opening helicopter sequence, you know you're in for something really interesting with this film and what the camera is going to do. And I just want to mention that going back to Nicholson's performance, we could probably spend the whole show just talking about that performance and what we make of it. There's no doubt he goes a little crazy, and he's big right away in this film. But watching it again this time, it occurred to me that there's actually a sense from the very beginning that everything here is preordained, which makes sense when you get to the end of the film. But you think about some of the references that are made early in this film. There's the Donner Party conversation as the family's driving to the Overlook, the music that is eerie right from the beginning of the film with the helicopter sequence, the fact that we learn that the hotel's built on a burial ground, an Indian burial ground, and you even get things like Shelley Duvall being shown the freezer and the storage room down in the kitchen as if it's foreshadowing that she's going to end up using this room later. So there's a sense that this family's doomed from the very beginning. It's not really about any kind of suspense building on whether or not Jack Nicholson is going to lose his mind. It's just a matter of when and how many casualties there are going to be.
Wendy, let me explain something to you. Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me. And it will then take me time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
Fine. And we're going to make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the f*** you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. Now, do you think you can handle that?
Yeah.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Adam Kempinar and our special guest, Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. That's funny that you say you watched it in bits and pieces first. I think I probably did the same thing, catching it on TV maybe or something like that, or turning it off as a kid when I couldn't take it. And I think that probably fed the power of it because this is a very subliminal movie. You get quick shots of horrifying things, and that's how it works when you sit down and watch it from start to finish. So even watching it in bits, you get a sense of that before you're ready for the whole thing. My recent watching experience, believe it or not, was in an off-season hotel. We were recently in northern Wisconsin on vacation, and we put it on in a hotel that thankfully had other guests, but I did think it was a little too close to home for the subject matter.
Wow.
Still terrifying stuff. I mean, this is a really frightening movie, and watching it again, I realized one of the things that's most impressive about it is that it doesn't really need suspense to terrify you. That's a little bit what you were getting at, Adam, in that it's clear from the beginning this guy's going to go off his rocker. The family is going to get it in some way. I guess there is that suspense that, okay, are the mom and kid going to make it out alive? But Kubrick doesn't really seem to be all that interested in whether or not they really make it out alive. He feels the need to serve that story, I guess, and I'm sure the studio demanded it. But you get a sense that it's all going to go really badly here.
Well, and that's part of the joke. I mean, he's got a pitiless sense of humor. He always has, and you know, it's not about creating this any kind of conventional suspense beats. It's all about, as Adam said, you know, what you get visually out of a film like that has all this sort of wide lens dread in every frame, and you don't really know what these details are even adding up to, but. You know, that heavy, as you say, that sort of heavy, methodical back and forth in sort of the simple dialogue scenes, there's always been a lot of deliberate, sort of a half second or second of dead air around every piece of dialogue in almost every Kubrick film that just makes you feel like something is amiss.
Something's off. It kills you off your filter.
Right. And no one was more amused in the most heartless way by banal small talk than Kubrick. You know, I mean, when you think of some of the conversations in 2001 early on or that meeting with Barry Nelson as the hotel owner where it just – or even just shots of Shelley Duvall and the boy, I'm forgetting the boy's
name. Lloyd.
Danny Lloyd, of course, Mr. Danny Lloyd. He's sitting in front of the TV, which is always on at the worst moments, while she's smoking like it's 1980, which it is, and smoking 2 inches away from him.
My wife commented on that, too. Hey, it was 1980.
It is like coffee tea or me with the cigarettes there. I mean, it is very smoking. Yeah, and Danny is eating the whitest bread, it's like a shade of Wonder Bread that is beyond white.
Right.
And this is, I think, not to make too much of what's encoded in this film, at least we will talk about that with the documentary, but that's what's kind of yanking Kubrick's chain with this material. It's that it's a way of getting at this family that's already corroded from the inside. We hear that Nicholson, you know, Jack Torrance character, in a drunken rage, yanked his son's, dislocated his son's.
A momentary lapse.
Yeah, momentary lapse of extreme violence, which we don't see, but we do hear about, and in a just sort of a weirdly casual way.
There isn't really that much violence.
No, not much violence.
That's another traditional horror tool that he sets aside. He doesn't rely on the suspense. He doesn't rely on that much violence, and yet I count this, for me personally, as probably the most frightening movie I've seen. It's all about those little subliminal shots of things that don't necessarily even matter for the main narrative at hand.
But like the elevator, the elevator. But also
the elevator.
Yeah.
Things that are just, when you look at them in the larger span of the story, they're not really necessary. Yet they are the things that haunt me. And maybe it's because they aren't necessary. You know, they aren't these obvious tools that I'm used to when I'm watching horror films. Instead, I get these odd images, the twins even, just standing there that I can't quite process or fit into the normal horror trajectory. And so it sets me off a little bit. I don't quite know what to do with them.
Let me say two things. First of all, I've stayed at much worse hotels. Secondly, do you guys both love this film? I do not love
it. I'd say I'm pretty close.
Love is a hard word to use for it. I feel manipulated by it in a way I admire. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, I kind of love it.
I was more intrigued than I remember, because it's not a film I saw more than once or maybe twice back when I was in college. But it does strike me as awfully minor Kubrick. It does. It does. I don't know why.
I think it's minor in terms of what is he really after here? And maybe that's part of what you're getting at, in the sense that here's someone who's just playing with a horror story that maybe he's not all that interested in. I do get a sense of that. Yet at the same time, that doesn't mean he set his craftsmanship aside. And so all the intricate care that is going into those tracking shots with the big wheel, or even the tour at the beginning, it's all to set up the geography of this hotel. Mm. And just to admire the amount of care and attention and how it pays off later when we are running through that hotel too. Now, this time for our lives. And it's very insidious, because he's given us so many tours of it with his camera that we think, okay, we should know where to go. We know where is a safe place. But then they start running, and it happens early on, which room 237 nods to, where Danny is on his big wheel downstairs, and without explanation, suddenly he's upstairs.
Yeah.
Mm. And suddenly we become disoriented, and we're thrown off because we should know this place, but we don't. He's screwing with us again. And that's just impossible not to admire.
I think, though, there is this larger question that we have to ask, which is, what is this film about? What do we take away from this film beyond maybe just being scared by it, or reflecting on and really admiring the craftsmanship? And one of the things that struck me this time, that I certainly didn't notice when I saw it originally back in college for the first time in its entirety, was that this really is a film about repression. There is this psychological terror, I think Kubrick is exploring, that can come from someone repressing themselves, from stifling their natural urges and desires. It actually made me think recently of our discussion of The Master, the Paul Thomas Anderson film. I see a little bit of that same kind of broken quality to Jack Torrance as I do in Freddie Quell, someone who's kind of haunted by his inability to be the man slash husband slash father he wants to be, or thinks he should be, or thinks society expects him to be. And so you think about the ways Jack Torrance is repressing himself. We know he can't drink anymore. And later, he can't wait to get a drink. He says, I think he'd give his soul to have one drink. He's a writer, but he's blocked. He can't say what he wants to say. He can't get that out there. And his relationship with his wife, of course, is interesting, too, because they don't seem to be that affectionate. They don't seem to be physical in any way with each other. And when Ullman is showing them around early on, when they're getting the tour originally, I love this little throwaway moment where two blonde women, attractive blonde women, are checking out, and they go by and they say goodbye to him. And of course, Jack's the last guy to go, and he has to look back at him and watch him go. I mean, he notices the blonde women, and of course he notices the naked blonde woman in room 237, which seems to be this room where maybe you get to explore those desires. You get to finally let it all out, whatever you're feeling. And I think that the key part for me is that conversation with Grady, who is the waiter, I think, in the gold room. And the actor, I had to write his name down, Philip Stone. I think he's so good. Mm-hmm. He is so fun to watch, just really relishing every single line. But when he talks to him later in the film, when Jack is trapped, the phrases he uses are really telling. He talks about how Jack is failing to take care of the problem. Failing. She seems to have gotten the better of you. She needs a good talking to. It's this constant suggestion that he has to assert himself over her. And he even says at one point, you don't have to rub it in.
I fear you will have to deal with this matter in the harshest possible way, Mr. Torrance. I fear that is the only thing to do.
There's nothing I look forward to with greater pleasure, Mr. Grady.
You give your word on that, do you, Mr. Torrance?
I give you my word.
I feel like Jack is this character who feels stifled. He feels like she's largely holding him back, and that's why he really can't abide her then holding his one mistake, his one eruption of violence against him the way he perceives that she does. And that misunderstanding, remember when she says, you did this to him, she thinks that he put his hands on him and choked him.
Right.
That's really what starts the slide where all the violence in this film comes from.
I think that's all there, and maybe this is what you're getting at, Michael. I think it's there on the surface, but for whatever reason, I don't really feel that the movie cares that much about it or is that invested in it. It's there narratively and to add a little bit of context, but I don't know that we can truly say that's what the movie is about. To me, the movie is about its own technique, and I don't know if you're looking for something
too shallow,
more
though,
than,
doesn't it?
I think it might be a pretty shallow movie, a brilliantly done movie, but possibly a shallow one. And I'm not saying that makes it bad, but that's maybe part of my distance from it, and I don't know if that's where your level of engagement is.
I mean, the wrong this time through, I thought, okay, what would make this? And I was kind of semi entranced by a lot of the thing visually, and that's nothing new for Kubrick, but there's something about the match of that director's meticulously, obsessively controlled visual approach. When you match that up with an actor as kind of methodically crazy as Nicholson, I mean, there's not a lot of surprise in the Nicholson performance. And I find that anytime Nicholson, even more recently in something as very different as About Schmidt, when he might more profitably play normalcy or sort of a neutrality and then kind of give you the intimations or the ripples of sort of, you know, what's going on behind the facade or whatever, he can't convey that because he doesn't have a lot of that in him. I mean, somebody, I forget who it was, Stephen King suggested, well, it should have been John Voight, you know, like 1980 era John Voight, somebody who can kind of start here and then go there. But, you know, once he got Nicholson in, and certainly didn't hurt, you know, the film was not a big success at the box office, but it's grown, you know, the reputation, like most of Kubrick's stuff, has grown with the passing years. Kubrick responded to the more operatic approach. And I just don't know if the film, to me, is fantastic in those flourishes you mentioned, Josh, just in that image that it comes back to a lot. And I never, without getting lazy, that image of the blood, you know, sort of seeping through these closed elevator doors and then gushing, you know, with the gallons and gallons. There's only, I learned in the making of film that his daughter, Kubrick's daughter, made the documentary, that there's really only one actual special effects shot in that film where Nicholson is looking at the model of the maze and then you see two tiny little characters.
Oh, yeah.
And that was actually, you know, two stand-ins, real actors, shot from a great height in kind of a recreation of the maze.
And that was
matted in. And that is a genuinely mysterious moment.
It really is.
Because you think, okay, what's going on? Can he really see them? Is he imagining it?
It's like he's the lord of this kingdom.
Yeah, I know.
Kingdom.
But it's not, you don't get a literal explanation. And that's what Kubrick is living for. He lives for that.
Right.
I'll say this about Nicholson's performance. It's probably the least frightening element to me in the movie. I enjoy it in terms of its comedy, really. Not bad comedy, but just it gets you laughing. And in that way, it maybe releases some tension. But if there was a way for The Shining to be scarier, it might be with a different lead actor. Mm. Because then that whole attack the family sequence, which to me, I start to feel like I've seen this. You know, I've seen variations on this. Again, not saying that it's bad or doesn't entirely work, but I wonder if The Shining would have been scarier with someone like John Voight in the lead that took a different tack.
This is what Kubrick makes you, even if you feel a little, not dismissive, but more like, okay, it's a minor work in my view. But even so many of his films provoke enormous objections, and you can kind of have objections to your own objections. Like, in other words, Barry Lyndon is a film that I feel like anything, as I say, anything post 2001, I'm not even sure where I stand on all of these movies anymore. Barry Lyndon, I did see two or three times when it came out. I was sort of just knocked out by it as a period piece. But at the same time, I thought, okay, any actor in the world would be better than Ryan O'Neal, and I still believe that. I that was purely for box office insurance, and he can barely get by, I think, in that picture. Hmm. And it's too bad that that film didn't have, essentially, more of an Albert Finney-level craftsman in there.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam Kempinar, Josh Larson, and Michael Phillips discussing The Shining in honor of Halloween. It's one of our sacred cow discussions we do every month or two here on the show. I guess I don't want to dwell on Nicholson too much more. I think we've covered it, but I do disagree because I think it fits in with how I'm reading the film in terms of this movie and the narrative being one that is preordained and a lot of the dread coming from not just that you know where it's going, but with him being so big and so clearly capable of violence. It then does become this interesting operatic question of, okay, how big is the carnage going to be? How much damage is he really going to do? I agree that it would be interesting to see someone like John Voight, someone more subtle, go on more of a progression to that point, but I think it works just as well, or maybe is even more scary because it is so operatic. And just to close, one small thing I was saying about his character and this kind of loser character that he seems to be responding to, that line about all work and no play that she reads on the typewriter. If you think about it, though, we've always kind of just joked about it. It's become a cliche. We know it's this nursery rhyme kind of line, but it does work in the grand scheme of this film where he's saying all work and no play makes him a dull boy. This idea that he has to be just a father who has to collect a paycheck, who doesn't get to do the fun things that he wants to do. It is an expression of him being stifled in some way. So again, I'm on board with Nicholson, but I do want to ask you guys about any of the aspects after probably viewing Room 237. As you watched The Shining, did you think about some of those things where you really focused in on some minor detail and maybe obsessed over it or tried to make too much of it?
It was hard not to, but I really tried to avoid that, actually, because I didn't want to be caught in that place where the people who are profiled in that documentary are. They're trapped by their theories
and we'll
get
to that film, yeah.
So, yeah, I tried to avoid that.
Well, there were three things that jumped out for me, and the first one is really, really minor. I just thought it was kind of a funny joke where he's in the office with Ullman, and he says, well, I've got a writing project that I'm working on. And of course, you think, well, I really hope he knows where he's going with this writing project because he's going to be there for 5 months. So if you're a writer, writing's already hard enough. But if you know where you're going, you have a basic roadmap, that could be very productive. He doesn't have a clue what he's doing. And I love the fact that he says he's got this writing project. And then what we learn is he didn't have a story. And Ullman says, well, I've got this little story for you. And it's the story about the Gradys and what went wrong there. And you almost have to think, if only Torrance had been smart enough to go, well, that's an interesting story. Why don't I write about that?
Just written it, not lived it.
Yeah, exactly. Then he'd have something. But I love the fact you mentioned, Michael, Danny eating the Wonder Bread, Shelley Duvall smoking as they're watching TV, they're eating lunch there in that opening sequence. The first time we meet Danny and Wendy. Do you remember what else Wendy is doing in that scene as she's smoking a cigarette and talking to Danny?
Well, she's wearing her watch over the red pullover, which looks
some interesting
like
style choices on her part.
Halfway to psychotic right there, but no, what is it?
What I noticed was she's reading a book. She's reading a book, and it happens to be Catcher in the Rye. And I just love the fact that she's married to a writer or an aspiring writer, and she's a reader. She's clearly a reader because
books are oppressive in those
early
scenes.
What we also see in the shot is behind Danny is a bookshelf full of books.
They're everywhere.
So, keeping with my theory about this pressure on him to be this certain kind of husband or man, she's a reader and he's a writer. And it also works nicely that it's Catcher in the Rye, written by a recluse, a guy who basically shut himself in. Right? You have to wonder if maybe
Adam, you're like the sixth guy that didn't make the final cut.
Why wasn't I in the film?
I know he really should have been.
Here's my last one, though. And
it keeps going.
You can totally scoff at this one. But think about why does Kubrick spends so much time showing Scatman Crothers, Dick Halloran, the chef, show Wendy all the food in the freezer. He spends like 5 minutes going through the number of ribeyes, all the different types of meat that are in the freezer. And I watch it and I was thinking, I think a lot of people wonder this as you watch The Shining. What is all that blood in the elevator? What is it supposed to symbolize in some way? And I'm thinking about all the animals that must have been slaughtered, right?
Just so they had a slaughterhouse in the basement is what you're saying?
No, not necessarily, but I wonder if there is a little bit of visual playfulness going on or textual playfulness on Kubrick's part to suggest that think about the number of animals. Forget the Indians that they've clearly, the people who built that territory, slaughtered. But then the people, they've dug up the bones to build the hotel on that burial ground. But then we've got the animals as well. The sheer quantity of animals that have to be slaughtered to keep that place running. That's the blood of the elevator.
I just assumed it was some of those early New Year's Eve parties in the 20s that got a little out of hand.
Maybe so.
The guy with the rabbit suit we see later, yeah.
What about then any major aspects of the film? We've covered a few of them. But what about things that maybe clearly didn't work for you beyond Nicholson's performance? Were there aspects of the film that didn't?
I think a lot of it is hooked up for me with questions about the casting of Nicholson and Duvall, frankly. Although, right, these days, of course, whatever one thinks of that movie, their faces in extremis, either reacting to or causing some horrifying moment of, you know, it's part and parcel of the movie's image. And it's why we kind of rolls around in our heads, even if we don't really know what we make of it.
Yeah.
I guess I find Kubrick's not, I wouldn't say sending up the material, but he...
It comes close sometimes.
He looks,
yeah.
He's not interested in, you know, but what is Eyes Wide Shut? Is that a conventional, you know, adherence to any genre?
Certainly not.
No. I got a huge issue with Eyes Wide Shut that I'm eager to revisit in a few years when I see it again, or maybe sooner, in that I think that story... Not necessarily with those actors, but that story came from a different period. I think it would have made more sense in a different period. I don't know. Hmm. I just always have these enormous questions with Kubrick in the later stuff about either casting or some decision. But at the same time, you have to admire how damn far he went with every single choice, often in, you know, the direction he always went. But, I mean, when you look at the visual quality of The Shining, and you have to go straight back to the trenches in Paths of Glory.
I mean,
he was doing amazing things in 1957 with the camera. He, never a subtle filmmaker in many ways. Not a subtle. He didn't view humanity or humans in extremis under attack in any particularly subtle way. But he somehow turned these simple parables of good and evil into the stuff of, if not necessarily nightmares, but it's stuff of the kind of very unsettling dreams. And that's why he's still the filmmaker he is.
Yeah.
I don't have any major criticisms for The Shining, but with your interpretive skills we've seen on display here, I do want you to explore, why do we get so much of Dick Halloran traveling to the hotel?
It's one of my notes.
We get him in Miami. We get him on the plane. We get him in the car. I mean, I'm surprised. Yeah. If there were computers around, we would have gotten him placing his order on Expedia for his plane ticket.
You're so right. It's one of my notes. That's one of the things I didn't understand about the movie.
It's absurd.
It doesn't really...
It's just misdirection.
It doesn't really detract from the film, but you're right. It's interesting that they show so... And you wonder maybe if he is trying to make...
It's like a 20-minute segment.
Maybe he's trying to make a sort of ironic joke out of it, because how much time does he devote to seeing Scatman Crothers get to the Overlook,
and then
once he gets there, he's killed in 30
instantly,
seconds.
Instantly.
It clearly seems to be a joke on his part, yeah. But you're right. I don't know why we had to spend that much time with him. The two things for me, and I'll just quote you directly from my notes as I watch the film, WTF the dog. The dog. Do you remember the sequence when Wendy is losing her mind and she finally sees the blood come out of the elevator? This is at the end of the film. Danny's being chased by Jack through the maze. She's looking for them in the Overlook, and she goes upstairs, and there's a sequence where character in a dog outfit.
No, that's
is
the rabbit man I was talking about.
It's
He's
a dog.
In a rabbit outfit.
I
isn't
think it's
he?
A dog, because I did some Google searching today to be like, there must be something on this. Apparently, it's in the book.
Okay.
And it was something Kubrick shot, but otherwise didn't explain it at all, except for that one shot where we see a dog seemingly performing a sex act on a man
that's
in a
hotel
room.
That's one of those subliminal things I'm talking about.
Yeah, but that's one of those things that completely doesn't fit in with anything else we see in the movie. And I think that whole sequence with Wendy doesn't really work, where things, we see the cobwebs, it kind of becomes a little bit too conventionally horror movie there.
Yeah, that's
for me,
a joke shot right there
with the rest of the film.
It's weird because a lot of it almost seems David Lynchian. And he was, by then, Lynch had made Eraserhead, and you know, I think The Elephant Man came out that same year. But Kubrick's kind of, the kind of rhythm he favors as a filmmaker, and the kind of anal attention to a certain pacing and this methodical vibe, he's always kind of sort of like hum, you know, like laying out. It's the opposite of the kind of really free-floating dream imagery that Lynch is into. So when you get a moment like that in The Shining, where you have this sort of, you know, Duvall kind of coming upon this salacious sexual act going on. It doesn't seem to be coming out of any kind of, like, subconscious or dream moment.
No, you're right.
It's laid out with this kind of ridiculously heavy hand, and I don't know.
Very matter of fact, you're right.
And at the same time, it's all part and parcel of Kubrick just as a filmmaker, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I want to ask this, though. Where do you put it in relation to the films it's nearest on the timeline? We have Barry Lyndon, and we have A Full Metal Jacket on the other side. Well, where does that go for you?
Wow.
Now, I've never seen Barry Lyndon, so I can't put it.
I haven't either, tragically.
I mean, overall, on Kubrick's
I'm sorry. I'm leaving.
You should.
I would put it at the top, but for different reasons. And the films that I value more, like 2001, would be way above it. If that makes any sense.
I don't know. Get back to me in bonus content. I'll have thought about it a little bit more in terms of where I rank this. I do want to mention one last thing, though, that I'm curious how you guys responded to, which is something that I don't even know if I'm saying it as a criticism. It's more just an open question I have about the film, which is I don't know how I feel about the fact that a major aspect of the plot revolves around Grady, a character who clearly doesn't, quote unquote, really exist, letting Jack out of the storage room in the basement of the Overlook Hotel. Because if you think about how the film is set up, obviously you have to buy in a little bit to supernatural things going on. Clearly, Danny has the shining, and Scatman Crothers has this ability to shine. You buy that. You also can buy very easily that everything that is going on in Jack's head is going on in his head. He's walking around the hotel. He thinks he's meeting these characters, but they're not, quote-unquote, really there.
Is all that cut and dry?
No, I don't think it is, but I think you can go with it. If you want to just suspend disbelief so far, you can say, okay, I get that certain characters have supernatural abilities. I get that this place is haunted.
So who bruised Danny in room 237?
Well,
then? Exactly.
You're right. So that's one of the things that comes up. And the other one would be him getting let out. It takes it to a plane where a film that's already clearly bizarre and out there and supernatural, it takes it to another level where then these ghosts in this house, it's not just haunted. Or it's not just a place that preys on your fragile mind. It can actually cause physical things to happen in the real world, like a ghostly character opening a door.
Yeah, I thought that worked well, actually.
It's just not completely in keeping, maybe, with the rest of the film.
I thought it was.
Adam, why are you so literal-minded? I don't understand.
It's a curse. It's part of my fragile mind, unfortunately, Michael. Well, The Shining is out on Blu-ray. You can also rent it digitally on various platforms if you want. We look forward to your thoughts on the film. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting. Our next Sacred Cow show is going to be our Spielberg Spectacular in late November. Michael Phillips, we plan to have you back. We're going to talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Excellent.
I wanted to just talk to my finger for Massacre Theater, but Adam convinced me we should probably let Michael play along. Plus, what does The Shining have to do with the Apollo moon landing? The documentary Room 237 explains next. Stay with us.
Down in the courthouse, they're signing their names. 10 years trying to remember the flame. He wants some split up. He tried to say who's to blame. But some pictures aren't so easy.
Again, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsors this week here on Film Spotting. We start with Hover, domain name registration and management that's simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to filmspotting.hover.com and enter the show code FILMSPOTTING.
We're also presented by FreshBooks, the cloud accounting service for small businesses. If you're in business for yourself, you know all the time that it takes to create invoices and deal with all that paperwork can be a real pain. FreshBooks has been around since 2004. It's a cloud accounting service that will save you time and get you paid faster. They have a new iPhone app that can track expenses. It turns hours into invoices on the go.
And one of those ways that it really helps small business owners is in your ability to create invoices easily and email them to your clients. They can view them online and pay you right on the spot with a credit card. And of course, when it comes tax time at the end of the year, which is my least favorite time of the year as I'm putting together Film Spotting's expenses, you know your accountant is going to enjoy that process a lot more, and you'll enjoy it a lot more because you'll be so organized. They also offer great customer support. You can call or email FreshBooks, and you will get a live person to reply.
FreshBooks will even let you try their service for free. Sign up right now, and you can get 30 days of unlimited use. All the features, clients, staff, everything with no limits, just by signing up at FreshBooks.com. Be sure to tell them that you heard about it from Film Spotting when asked during sign-up. There's no other URL or promo code to give, so mention Film Spotting. Again, if you sign up right now, you can get 30 days of unlimited use just by signing up at FreshBooks.com. Join the 5 million FreshBooks users that have been sending and paying invoices. We thank FreshBooks for their support.
It. The music from my dream.
Their whole movement I wrote imagining us meeting again and again in different lives, in different ages.
I can't explain it, but I knew when I opened that door,
a powerful deja vu ran through my bones.
I heard it in a dream. I was in a nightmarish cafe, and the waitresses, they all had the same face.
No reason to hide. I know you are Sonmi 451.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson and Michael Phillips. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's the trailer for the new film Cloud Atlas, starring Tom Hanks. And it's a movie we're going to discuss a little bit as we get to our poll question this week and anticipate our discussion of that movie next week here on the show. Right now, though, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a screenplay badly and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
I want us to be when I am more set. That's set, yes.
Oh, so it's about finances.
Well,
it's about money.
No, Phyllis, it's not about money, okay? And don't make it sound like that. Don't make it like, okay? It's not like that, okay? Because why I'm here working, trying to do something, is very hard, and then, you know, my brother's driving me crazy, okay? I'm just saying that it's about money. Yes, it's about money, okay? If you wanted to say, yes, it's about, I'm sorry you don't understand money.
Oh, yeah, okay? I don't understand money.
It's very difficult. What did you say?
I understand money.
Ah, good.
That's Minnie Driver as Phyllis and Stanley Tucci as Secundo in 1996's Big Night, directed by Tucci and Campbell Scott, screenplay by Tucci and Joseph Tropiano.
Obvious tie in there. Our top five list was movies directed by their stars, and that was a Tucci accent, not an Italian accent that I did. Just to be clear.
However you want to classify it, Josh, it was offensive. That's all I'm going to say. If you want to hear that top five and our review of Argo that inspired it, that was a fun discussion. You can check that out at filmspotting.net or find the show in iTunes. Not a lot of entries this week, which I predicted would happen. Maybe it was because of your accent work. Or maybe it was just the fact that Big Night isn't a widely seen film, which is too bad because it's a really good film.
Yeah, I think it made a lot of noise when it first came out because people really were attached to it, but it's kind of faded.
Maybe it has, unfortunately. Maybe more people will be encouraged to check it out after hearing
your
massacre.
I don't think after our performance that's going to work.
Last week, Josh. Michael, you can reach into the Film Spotting hat. It's not brimming at all. There's lots of room there and pick out this week's winner.
But there is more than one.
There is.
Let's be honest. Okay, the winner is Kenny Meyer, Palm Desert, California.
Congratulations, Kenny. Email feedback at filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays.
The show must go on.
No, dear. Margot must go on.
It's time now for our Halloween edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Well, there's no accent work this week unless Michael wants to introduce into the scene, which I'm fine with, Michael. You bring the truth. You go wherever you have to go with this scene.
I'll be doing a southeastern Wisconsin dialect.
That'll be tough for you to draw on that, but we'll go for it. We'll tell you that this scene does tie in with our Halloween theme, specifically our top five terrifying movie characters. Josh, you started off. Are you ready?
I am.
And action.
Maybe she's just run off on a spree.
Oh, no.
Well, there's no harm in hoping.
Ain't no sense in it either. I figured something like that was brewing when she went to bed last night.
How?
Well, she tarried around in the kitchen after I'd gone up, and when I went downstairs to see what was wrong...
What?
Well, she found this jar of dandelion wine that the husband had hid somewheres in the cellar she was drinking.
Oh.
I tried to save her.
I know you did. Oh, I know how hard you tried.
But the devil wins sometimes.
And scene.
Broke into a Johnny Cash song, you know, there.
I loved it.
There's that, but it started out more of a Bing, like Bing Crosby.
A little bit more.
They can evolve as the scene goes on. That's allowed.
That happens a lot here on Film Spotting. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, October 30th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I met this six-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
The great Donald Pleasance is Dr. Sam Loomis there in that scene from John Carpenter's Halloween, laying out for you everything you need to know about just how evil and how scary Michael Myers is. And last week on the show, we were looking forward to our Halloween show this week and our top five terrifying movie characters. We asked you this poll question. You're alone. Your car just broke down in the middle of nowhere. A figure appears out of the woods. Who do you most hope it isn't? And we picked from four classic horror movie villains. Your options were Freddy Krueger, Jason from Friday the 13th, Leatherface from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or Mike Myers. Josh, how did it come out?
Very little respect for Jason, actually. 14% in last place. Michael Myers received 21%. Just ahead of him, Freddy with 23%, which means Leatherface won 42% of the vote.
And we both did go with Leatherface.
We did.
So listeners followed suit there. It's been all week a neck-and-neck battle between Michael Myers and Freddy. At taping time, we call it, for Freddy by 1%. Michael, how would you have gone in this poll question?
I would have gone with Dax Shepard in almost anything.
Nothing more needs to be said. We did get a great comment on this poll. We get to hear from Chris Bowen and his process of elimination with this question.
Okay, he says, number one, I could outrun Leatherface. He's too big to chase the average person down. Number two, Michael Myers isn't that tough, and I've never seen him do anything but walk slowly towards his prey.
Very true.
So it's an easy getaway, he says. Number three, says Chris, Freddy would no doubt stop to make an amusing joke or two before commencing the hunt, so plenty of time to scamper. That leaves us with Jason. No matter where you are and how quickly you try to get away, he's almost always one step ahead of you, ready to leap out from behind a tree slash rocks slash shed, etc.
Very well argued.
Yeah, some good points there.
Very analytical, but we also heard from Tyler L. with his response.
Michael Myers doesn't stop. Once he's set on killing you, he will.
You heard it from Sam Loomis, and how do you argue with Donald Pleasance? So certainly I could see Mike Myers over Jason as well in that question. Or actually, I take that back. Some of the Friday the 13th movies scared me more than Halloween scared me. I like Halloween better as a film. But
the problem
Jason
with Mike Myers is he would go to stab you and then miss by 5 feet, because that happened quite a bit in Halloween.
Now, is it true, Adam, that because you were scared by the Friday the 13th movies, you still haven't had sex?
Exactly. And I don't camp. Okay. And I don't have sex while I camp. So I'm sorry. That's just the way it is. Well, that brings us to this week's poll question, though I don't know how I follow up that comment from Michael. We're looking ahead to next week and our review of Cloud Atlas. This is a film co-directed by the Wachowski siblings, Lana and Andy, and Tom Tykwer. So we're giving you some options here. Which of these European directors should make a film with the Coen brothers? Let's take another American directing team that we love, and our listeners love, the Coen brothers, and match them with one of these great contemporary European filmmakers. Michael, their options are.
I'd also like to point out that this question was never asked by Roger and Gene.
I bet it wasn't.
The four options are Pedro Almodovar, Michael Haneke, Lars von Trier, or Wim Wenders.
How do you want to do it? Do you want to find the director there, Josh, who seems to fit best and mesh with the Coen brothers, or find someone who clashes with the Coen brothers a little bit?
I don't want to see any of this.
No?
These all
one of these options wouldn't excite
horrible.
You?
None of these combinations. No. No, thank you.
Well, I didn't
I
get your comments
from voting.
Today on the poll question. Maybe you could have come up with some better options.
See, I don't mean it's a bad poll question. I just don't want to see any of these films.
No, see, Michael? I want to see.
Yeah, humor me.
Okay, I want to see the Wachowskis and Teichfer and the Coen brothers and all four of these possible directors take on How the West Was Won. So I want them to shoot How the West Was Won.
Nice.
Sounds great.
Almodovar, fabulous style. I mean, it'll be fabulous.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a week to think about it, Josh, and I'm going to think about it, too, for a week. We're going to come back with an answer.
Ugh.
And maybe we can just go with the populist choice here, see how it comes out and follow suit with our listeners. We want to know what you think. It's the most important poll question
ever.
Vote now at filmspotting.net. A couple other quick notes I did want to mention. A little bit of a correction, or I guess a clarification. We've heard from a few listeners on this, Josh, calling us out for our top five list last week in our exemption. We did our top five movies directed by their stars. And in order to try to make it more interesting, frankly, we ruled out a whole bunch of great directors who have made some classic films, some of the best films ever made, who frequently cast themselves in their movies. So this would include Woody Allen, it'd include Clint Eastwood, it'd include Orson Welles. There were like six directors we marked off, Michael. And we gave them this umbrella title of auteurs. And we said, we're not going to include these auteurs. But then on our top five lists, I included Francois Truffaut and Josh included Jean Renoir. So
what a bunch of hypocrites.
Yeah, it seemed hypocritical
to some people.
But yeah, there is an explanation. We really were just looking for a way to exclude the people who cast themselves a lot in
exactly.
their movies. That's all it was.
Yeah, and I even looked up to see, because I wasn't all that familiar with all of Renoir's films, and
he only appeared in one or two.
Rules of the Game, and one other one, I think. Yeah, so that's kind of how I looked at it.
So you're just in the bag for the French, basically.
Basically, we just didn't choose to define auteur by design. We didn't want to sidetrack the show with it, as we're sidetracking the show now. Nevertheless,
anyway,
that clarification is out there. I do always want to plug our great sister show, Film Spotting SVU. Matt Singer, Allison Wilmore, their bi-weekly podcast. They had a new show that just came out this week, and they discussed the listener's choice review of this new documentary called Indie Game, the Movie, about video game makers. So then jumping off from that, they shared some of their favorite titles that are influenced by video games, movies like Existenz and Scott Pilgrim versus the World that are currently available via streaming. So there's always great recommendations every 2 weeks there on Film Spotting SVU. They're going to fill up your queue. So encourage you to check that out. Go to filmspottingsvu.com or just do a search in iTunes. And lastly, we want to plug our bonus content. If you're a Film Spotting app user, you get this extra bit of audio every week. You can find our apps in the iTunes App Store or Amazon's App Store for Android. And this week, we're going to make Michael stick around. We're going to chain him to the desk, and we're going to talk a little bit about the AV Club's recent top 50 films of the 90s. We're also going to get, I couldn't resist, Josh, I mentioned my student film a few weeks ago on the show, The Melancholy of a Lost Dog. Really funny email from a listener who imagines classic films with that title. So we'll
such a
get
great
to that.
Title.
It
such
really
a great
is.
Title.
Thank you. Not a great film, but a great title. We'll also share a few thoughts on some of the films that screened at the recent Chicago International Film Festival.
I think a lot of things happened right here in this particular hotel over the years. And not all of them was good.
What about room 237?
Room 237?
You're scared of room 237, ain't you?
No, I ain't.
Mr. Allen, what is in room 237?
Nothing. There ain't nothing in room 237.
That's Scatman Crothers and Danny Lloyd in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining talking about what is or isn't in Room 237. There's a new documentary that's been playing on the festival circuit, played here recently at the Chicago Film Festival, called Room 237, that focuses on five different theories about the various hidden meanings in The Shining, including one that posits it's really all about Kubrick exploring the guilty feels over his role in faking the moon landing. One says it's all about the Holocaust, another the genocide of Native Americans. We only see the names of the various theorists and hear their voices because the director, Rodney Asher's visual strategy is to avoid talking heads and instead use clips from The Shining, other Kubrick films and other films or commercials or cartoons to offer up their evidence, sometimes matter-of-factly, sometimes with a touch of irony. I'm curious, Michael and Josh, if you found Room 237 fascinating as a piece of criticism about a mysterious and provocative film, or as a piece of criticism about a mysterious and provocative approach to film criticism, one writer Chuck Klosterman refers to as immersion criticism, or did you not find it fascinating at all?
I think all of us sound like these crackpots.
I certainly did.
At some point or another in every time we come on Film Spotting, for one thing. But anytime we get cranked on the subject of a movie that for us holds some level of fascination, this is how we sound. We sound like a bunch of metaphor and simile crazed idiots who are so busy looking at the trees they don't know what forest they're in. But I did find it's not a film that I've lived with my adult life, The Shining. So I came to it more of as a tourist, but I did find some of the details fascinating. The fact that in one scene, you know, which we kind of see through frame blow-ups, Jack Nicholson is waiting to kind of meet his new bosses at the hotel, and he's in a hotel lobby, and the camera's just far enough back to not reveal what magazine he's idly reading in the lobby, and it's a Playgirl.
Yeah.
And I know that's just an on-set joke, and they knew that it wouldn't be seen by most, you know, I mean, except until these Shining obsessives started examining every granule of this picture. You know, that's an in-joke, but it's... kind of caught my eye.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did find, you know, God knows it's all, this is a movie about people who overreach as a hobby. I mean, mm-hmm. they're just this idea of like turning it into kind of a metaphor or an examination of a Holocaust. You know, somebody else is obsessed with the number 42, which recurs a little bit in the film.
I mean, 2 × 3 × 7, 42.
Okay, fine, that's accurate math. I don't find that necessary, but if you get into and these people aren't you know, they're not Unabombers. They're
no.
not crazy. I mean, they have this guy Bill Blakemore who decided that the film was essentially about the genocide of the Native American. And we do get that detail about the hotel was built on Indian burial grounds. I mean, that's there. But,
it is.
But his evidence is essentially all about seeing this can of Calumet baking soda in the background in a couple of scenes. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. That's the whole theory.
Or so, largely it, yeah.
So, yeah, no, half of it's ridiculous. The idea that it's a – I mean, you can, Josh, you can tell me about the moon landing. I still didn't quite get that, except that he liked what he saw in 2001, this theorist, and he thought, well, therefore he faked the moon landing.
Well, I will tell you, if you type metaphor and simile crazed idiots into the iTunes search bar, you'll get films.
You'll get the show.
So you're pretty dead on there. Mm-hmm. I think there's a spectrum of these theories for sure, and some of them that you can say, oh, I can see where they're coming from, and yeah, that does build. And some of them, like the Apollo moon thing, are just way out there. And it might be fun to play if you had to choose which theory you're going to side with in this movie, which one are you going to go with? Mm. The one that I actually found pretty arresting was the discussion of the window in the hotel manager's office. And a woman had actually created a map of the Overlook Hotel and had found out, rightly, I think, that there's no way this interior office could suddenly have this big window.
But what does that say, though?
To me, it ties in with the overall emphasis Kubrick puts on geography
and disorienting you.
Disorienting you and not quite letting you get your bearings while letting you think you have your bearings. So I did like that one. I don't know if this is a film so much about movie criticism as it is maybe movie love, and where that crosses over into movie stalking. You kind of get that sense with some of these people.
Yeah.
But it definitely captures, and in an affectionate way, and I think that's the key to this documentary and why it is fun, it definitely captures the way people's love for films can become so all-consuming, yet without ridiculing the people. It never crosses that line for me. I think that's part of
there
not showing...
There are elements there, but I agree.
Well, I think overall it's giving their theories their day and
yeah.
recognizing that it comes out of genuine appreciation for this film and for cinema in general. I mean, this really could have gone after these folks and hammered them for their ridiculousness.
No,
and I never felt that it did that.
It's got sort of an interesting stance because it's really just about I think this documentary Room 237 is really just about how movies are whatever we want them to be and how much they pull out of our own experience, and suddenly all these people at one time or another, not all of them, but the majority of these people we hear from in the documentary start talking about kind of where they are, where they were in their lives when they first met this movie, and whether or not they start, they related a little too closely to Jack Torrance's, you know, problems or whatever. It's about how the movies bring out some sort of side of ourselves that, you know, we just suddenly, these details become massively important. And then often, you know how it is. You find yourself in the middle of a discussion, you just start laughing at how kind of knotted up and crazed you are about one little point. And
yeah,
in the end, you know, it is only a movie, but when it's something like The Shining, if you have all these crazy, disparate theories rolling around in the world because of it, then something's going on with this medium.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the movie Room 237, which is a movie about the movie The Shining. It played recently here at the Chicago International Film Festival. I guess I want to get in a little bit to why this movie is about film criticism and actually talk, Josh, about one critic who feels very strongly that the director, Rodney Asher, did need to take a little bit more of a hardline approach to how he presented the theorists here in this film. And I just want to start by saying that this was a fascinating watch for me because it's just an interesting time for me to see it and consider it coming off a couple recent discussions here on the show. And I want to be clear, I'm saying this not to rehash any arguments we've had about films.
You want to talk about Argo again?
I'm just going to mention it because I just want to give everyone an idea of where my head was at as I watched this movie. Not just Argo, but The Master. I've only seen The Master once, but I've basically been engaging, along with others, in this same type of immersion criticism since I saw it. I've been obsessing about every little detail in the film and coming up with my theories about what Paul Thomas Anderson is really trying to say. And that's been a fact since I saw it for the past 3 weeks or so. With Argo and The Master, Josh, certainly respect your opinion, your right to see a film differently than I do, but I've been wrestling with our different interpretations of those films and the substance of what we don't see eye to eye on. And I've been wrestling with how obviously film criticism is subjective and we should allow and embrace that. But there's also that part of me that starts to wonder, but does the film really substantiate both or either of our takes? Objectively, is there something you can say about these films that maybe one of our readings just doesn't quite match the movie? So again, with that as background, I come to a movie like Room 237 and it forces me again to really examine those questions, watching these people on screen do some of the same things that I've been doing with these films. The critic I want to mention, though, is Jonathan Rosenbaum, formerly the Chicago Reader. He talked about Room 237 after seeing it at Toronto, and this is what he says about it. He calls it entertaining and reprehensible. Alternating between the extravagant commentaries of five analysts, it refuses to make any distinctions between interpretations that are semi-plausible or psychotic, conceivable or ridiculous, implying that they're all just, quote, film criticism. And because everyone is a film critic nowadays, they all deserve to be treated with equal amounts of respect and or mockery.
I like that. I think that's I think that's astute. There's something about this film that does seem, it's not open mockery. But there's something about the way it does kind of create almost two level of playing field.
Okay.
And in a way, you're just kind of dealing with, it's like a movie version of a comment board, and you're not really getting any curatorial distinction
about what's worth listening to. Clearly, Rodney Asher chose to sit by and present, comment a little bit, sometimes subtly, sometimes not subtly, with the visuals he chose. But otherwise, he chose to give them all their due, no matter how ridiculous they are. And I do hear what you're saying and what Rosenbaum is saying, but I just can't say that I find anything reprehensible about it, because rather than being an analysis of what The Shining is really about, I think it actually becomes its own separate piece of art. There is this clash or clarity of the images and the sound that opens up its own new mysteries, and I think it works on that level. And I don't think Rodney Asher is in any position, I don't think any of us are really in any position to completely rule out or verify and validate any one of these theories or throw out certain parts and embrace others. That would be a different film. It'd be an interesting film, but I'm really happy with the one we got that did present them all as equal, and it lets us decide what's ridiculous and what isn't, the same way Kubrick does.
I don't think it's positioning itself as serious criticism.
No.
Rosenbaum's take seems to be a defensive one to me, because this isn't a documentary that's trying to be definitive. It's not about serious criticism, and I think the nice balance it strikes is that while it recognizes that these folks aren't offering what Rosenbaum may have been looking for in the movie, their views are still worth entertaining in a non-derisive way. That's what I liked about it.
Sure.
I'd agree with that, Josh, except that the theory that holds The Shining to be kind of an extrapolation of the slaughter of Native Americans, and then the other theory that deals with the worst slaughter of the 20th century, the Holocaust, I found the fun, the quote fun aspect of this movie to kind of curdle. And it does make those theories properly somewhat ridiculous and dismissible.
But it's not about the theories themselves.
No, but it's
about the love that they're born out of, that these people have for movie watching.
Yeah.
I guess I don't find that all that compelling, though. I want to get into the substance of what they're saying and the substance of The Shining and see if they really are illuminating anything. And I think that's the problem. They don't. I think that in the end, even though I do really appreciate this film and I'm glad I saw it and I'd watch it again, what I find insufficient in what they're presenting is that I don't think many of their theories and all these obsessions and all this time they've put into these details, I don't think they really lead to a deeper understanding of the movie they should be talking about. They help support beliefs and an understanding of whatever cause or concern they're most obsessed with. So it's not about Kubrick subtly.
But that's interesting
it's
to
not
me
about,
on its own,
It
though.
Is interesting, but it's not as interesting for me as getting back to the film and trying to shed light on that. And so you can still have totally a subjective response. I'm not saying I wanted Asher to shed light on the film, but I wish that they were trying to do that, because what I think happens is they focus on something like the genocide. It doesn't become about Kubrick invoking that in a way to shed insight on the characters themselves or the struggle or what it tells us about the world we live in. It really becomes for them about genocide. They see the movie almost as a puzzle that's all about genocide, and I don't see Kubrick as giving us a puzzle we're supposed to solve in that way.
No, but
you're asking
for like a bonus feature on the DVD release of The Shining, which we get plenty of.
I'm asking those analysts to reflect on the film more and not
That's what a bonus feature does. This is a film about people who have incorporated their love or their obsession or their interest in a movie in such a way that it has bled into these other great areas of influence or interest of theirs for some reason. So that may make it a limited film in a sense, and that you're not getting to the text in a way you might, but I don't know that that's what it set out to do. If it had been more clearly stated at the beginning, we are going to visit some people who have really figured out The Shining, then you could say, well, it's a fault because they never did that. But from the very beginning, for me, it seems to be, here are some fascinating people who have become obsessed about The Shining.
I'm not being critical of Asher and his choice. I'm being critical of the analysts.
They're not analysts.
I'm using analysts loosely as five
people.
They're
not critics.
They're clearly people. Well, some of them are, actually, and they've clearly chosen to analyze this movie to death. So I'm going to call them analysts. And I feel like I wish that they were devoting their attention more to actually reading the film, not trying to just support whatever cause they're looking at or seeing this grand scheme. I wish they were talking about how all those elements they're seeing make the film more interesting, make the film about something more.
They do make it interesting. To them, it does.
To me, that kind of analysis is such a dead end because a film like The Shining or even something like a puzzle movie that people really loved breaking down and trying to decode and crack the mysteries of, something like Inception, where that's what it is. It is a puzzle, sort of a very artful, hollow puzzle, I think. Not unentertaining. I liked it. It's not a film I've ever wanted to see a second time, frankly, Inception, but it did the job once. It exists to be its own parlor game. And to the degree anybody knows what a parlor game is anymore, but you know,
is that on the internet?
Yes, it's pre-internet.
I play that on the Twitter.
It's pre-internet actually. Parlor game. You know, when you gather around the piano and sing song. It's not that. That's all that kind of discussion is good for. And I guess I see Room 237 as, you know, an entertaining minor little goof on a minor Kubrick film. And I hate to be that dismissive.
I think that's all it's trying to be, really.
Yeah, I think on that level
it's successful. Yeah. I definitely do. But I think that what you're saying, Michael, is accurate about why it's easy to dismiss some puzzle movies. I love movies that are puzzles if I think they're ultimately
about something larger about the human condition
and actually saying something. I do, as I said during our discussion of The Shining, I think Stanley Kubrick is actually getting at some of those elements. I wish these analysts were, rather than trying to make all the puzzle pieces just fit a certain way to fit into their worldview.
What you're saying is that the way you fit everything together to fit into your worldview of
it's
this
totally
story
subjective.
Of this father
right.
and all these issues
but it comes back
has
to the
more weight than what these people
no,
have from
I'm
their
not.
Worldviews.
Well, I'm trying not to say that. That's fine if you want to interpret it that way. What I'm saying is how I interpret the film ultimately goes back to reading the film and trying to say what the film is saying about itself, what theme Stanley Kubrick might be getting at. Saying it's about the genocide, that's not a theme. That's not telling us anything about the world.
They
that's
very just, carefully that's just lay out all of the elements that have led them to that. We may say that they're ridiculous and they're misreading
but
them.
But it doesn't shed any insight on the film itself.
It's the same methodology. It's the same methodology. It doesn't to you because you don't agree with it.
No, it's not about agreeing or disagreeing, because I see a lot of the elements they're bringing up and I think those elements are there. But I'm saying, for example, if you're going to invoke genocide, if you're going to invoke the Holocaust, I actually think those elements are there. If you're going to invoke the genocide of Native Americans, I think some of those elements are there. I think part of their theories are done. But I want to then look at those in a way that then goes back to viewing the film a certain way. What does that say about Jack Torrance, the character? What does that say about this family dynamic? Not what it says about the Holocaust.
You're bringing it right back to your interpretation about Jack Torrance and the family. Maybe
no, I'm
for
saying
these
it's about
people,
the
that's a secondary
guys, I'm saying it's
guys,
about the characters.
Guys, the elevator doors are opening. The blood is flowing fast.
We are getting to a point where we're now debating semantics, unfortunately, but I guess that's bound to happen with a movie like Room 237. I do feel like that some are certainly more easily dismissible than others, and unfortunately, the one woman here, Julie Kearns, her whole thing about the Minotaur, and she goes off on the picture her son drew, and it reflects perfectly part of the film. That was the stuff where I really started tuning out, unfortunately. But some of the stuff about the Holocaust, as I said, and the Native Americans, it's there. I mean, the one that's really fascinating, I rewound it like three times for my wife, is the one about this little throwaway line when Wendy and Danny are running outside early in the film, and they're going to race to the maze, and she says, "Loser has to keep America clean."
Mm-hmm.
Now, who would ever say that?
What?
Yeah, she says, "Loser has to keep America clean." And in Room 237, they cut to, my wife knew it right away, the famous commercial
it's
with the
PSA,
Native American,
yeah.
The public service
oh,
announcement,
yeah.
Where they say, "Keep America clean,"
it.
And the Native American sheds one tear. Why would Kubrick put in that line, not "loser's a rotten
egg"?
Okay,
now, here's my wonky, you know, moment. I do think that this film primarily is a critique of American junk culture. And this is what Kubrick, who's American, but...
He mocks TV in there.
Hadn't lived there, you know, he's not an American by temperament. He's not really any nationality by temperament. He just is on his own planet, Kubrick, right, as a filmmaker. And it's lines of dialogue like that, and it's visual details like the whitest Wonder Bread I've ever seen ever being eaten, where you just sort of get this, all these things do add up, in my view, if you want to look at it this way, to kind of, okay, here's an American family in a little bit of trouble. And
without a doubt.
And it's because of what, it's just not just because they have an axe murderer about to kind of visit all kinds of hell upon them from the inside, it's because of the visually and atmospherically and in terms of the TV they're ingesting and all the rest of it, it's the life they're living.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people are all kind of cracked to begin with. So that to me, that's about as far out on the metaphor as I'm going to go with The Shining.
Well, I appreciate it, Michael. I'm not aware of any release dates for Room 237 yet. I don't think any have been announced, but you can get more information about the film at room237movie.com.
For the next segment, picture the three of us huddled around a campfire trying to freak each other out with our lists of the most terrifying movie characters. I bet Michael and I can get Adam to cry first.
It's going to happen.
The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Well, I got a girl, I got a little queen. We got friends and maybe someday family. I got some money I pulled from a pair of jeans. And I just got to shave them, but no, it's not too. I'm not too clean.
Time for our favorite part of the show, thank yous, where we give some love to our very generous donors who have supported the show this past week and beyond. But first, we do want to give a shout out to a local Chicago filmmaking group. It's called Chicago Filmmakers, and they have a new series called their Green Screen Environmental Series. Obviously, this is really going to only affect our podcast listeners who are in the Chicago area, but this series features documentaries that focus on various environmental issues and how citizens are creating public awareness. Their next event is Friday, November 16th at 8 p.m.
They're going to be showing Beyond Pollution, which is a documentary that's a firsthand investigation of BP's disastrous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The doc uncovers what really happened, why it happened, and who benefited from it. You can find out more information about the whole series at chicagofilmmakers.org.
We also want to give a shout out to our featured musical artist this week. It's a band called Little Legend. That's a new group to me, and we got an email from someone associated with the band named Joe, who wrote in and said, "I love your podcast and the music you play. We'd love to submit a song to be played on your show. We're called Little Legend. We play music in the vein of Delta Spirit, Kings of Leon, Deer Tick, and Bruce Springsteen." And I like that combination, Josh. Gave a couple of their tracks a spin, and they're really good. So that's why we're featuring Little Legend this week on the show. We also like to give a shout out every week to our partner over at the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. He is Jeff Goldsmith. He interviews screenwriters, has some great interviews every week. You can get his podcast in iTunes. And recently he's had Rian Johnson on to talk Looper. He's replayed the Rian Johnson episode about Brick, and also recently had Penn and Teller on from a Comic-Con panel. So we always encourage you to check out the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, which again, you can just do a search in iTunes and find it there easily. Josh, that brings us to our donations this week and some great notes from our very generous listeners. We start with three new $10 a month donors to the show. Really fantastic to see. We want to thank Shannon in Arlington, Virginia. And we got this note from Kendall in Raleigh, North Carolina.
"I just started a $10 a month donation in honor of my husband Ted's birthday. We've been faithful Film Spotting listeners for several years and have been remiss in not helping out sooner. Ted's birthday seems the perfect occasion to start. Thanks so much for your thoughtful commentary, which often leads to spirited discussions as we do not always agree with you or each other. Thanks to you, we have seen a number of films that we might otherwise never have heard of. Please consider coming to Durham for the 16th Annual Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, which takes place April 4 to 7 in 2013. We'd love to have you visit."
Only if you'll make a space on the couch for us, because we're kind of cheap and...
That's how we travel.
We're just going to live at your house, exactly. But thank you very much for that note, Kendall, and of course, happy birthday to Ted.
Yeah, I hope he gets something else besides
the donation.
Too. That would be nice. Otherwise, I feel bad for Ted.
This is very special, Josh. You just take it for granted. But the Full Frame Festival in Durham is one I've always wanted to go to because I love documentary cinema, and I've never been to North Carolina, and it sounds lovely, frankly. So maybe at some point, the problem is that first week in April, and really the entire month of April, is usually a terrible one for me. So I don't know if it will ever happen, but Kendall and Ted will definitely look you up if we ever make it down there. We also got a new $10 a month donation from, and I hope I'm saying his last name right, it looks like John Newfry here in Chicago.
"I've been listening for a couple years now. I can't honestly remember which show I started with, but I can say I was committed enough to be a little scared at the Adam versus Maddie blow up before the show reviewing I'm Still Here."
Yeah, this is a famous Film Spotting moment. Really, maybe Maddie's most brilliant idea in the history of his time on the show, where instead of just doing the conventional setup for I'm Still Here, Maddie had the idea to basically mimic I'm Still Here and have us completely self-destruct in the middle of the review.
Nice.
and take it out of normal radio, where maybe the listener starts to think, is this really happening?
Sounds very meta.
It was very meta, and it worked because we got emails from people who thought the show was coming apart when it was really all an act. So yeah, that's what he's referring to there. That was a fun experiment, Josh.
Anyway, he writes, "Film Spotting has encouraged me to watch a number of things now that I wouldn't have otherwise seen, among them Moon, Another Earth, The Mirror, and Brick."
Thanks so much for that, John. He happens to be a longtime WBEZ supporter as well. We both really appreciate your support. Also got a Silver Club donation from Patrick in Des Moines, Iowa. Thanks so much, Patrick. And a couple other donors we want to thank here real quick. Gabriel Diani in Los Angeles. This was so clever, I had to read it here, Josh. We had to include it.
"I discovered the podcast a couple months ago and have thoroughly enjoyed listening to you, even when I don't agree. Chaplin's The Great Dictator doesn't even get an honorable mention in the top five doppelgangers."
He's onto something.
"I'm a filmmaker myself, and though you might see this donation as a transparent attempt to bring my film, The Selling, to your attention, I can assure you there's nothing further from the truth. I am donating to Film Spotting for entertaining and enlightening me as I've washed dishes, walk the dog, and done other various chores not connected with the production and marketing of a multi-award-winning comedy about a real estate agent trying to sell a haunted house that has played at over 25 film festivals around the world, won over a dozen awards, and received rave reviews from The Huffington Post, Ain't It Cool News, Fangoria, Filmmaker Magazine, Film Threat, and others.
Gabriel did say the film was called The Selling, right?
Yeah,
He's doing a fine job of it. He goes on, you should in no way feel obligated to watch the trailer, even though as children of the 80s and fans of Ghostbusters and Spies Like Us, it'd probably be right up your alley. Nor should you, for some strange reason, watch the trailer and enjoy it. Download an HD version of the film for free at this link and watch it regardless of the fact that I wouldn't expect a review or mention of the film on the podcast, but would only hope to get on your radar so that perhaps my next film might have that honor. No, don't do any of that. That's not why I'm donating. I'm donating because I truly do love the podcast and admire the way you're able to find small films without huge studio marketing budgets that many of your listeners haven't heard of and champion them. That, and I agreed with everything you said in your Dark Knight Rises episode, both of them.
Very nicely done.
Very well done. If you want to get your plug in for your movie and you can do it that cleverly, we'll probably find time here in the donation segment. But it really is so heartwarming to see the support we've gotten recently. We always have $2 a month donors and $5 a month, and then we get a few new $10 a month donors. As we say, it does keep us doing what we're doing. So thanks again to everybody for supporting the show.
Hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
If the rule you followed brought you to this, of what use was the rule?
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
You mean the nature of this conversation?
I mean the nature of you. You could have the money, Anton.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam, Josh, and Michael Phillips. That's Javier Bardem as Anton Chigurh and Woody Harrelson as Carson McKee, I believe his name is, in that great scene from the Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. And that leads us nicely into the Film Spotting Top 5 this week, terrifying movie characters in honor of Halloween. Specifically, we wanted to play that clip, Josh, of Anton Chigurh because he's a character I think a lot of us would agree is very scary. I certainly wouldn't want to run into him in my real life. But with this list, I know we deliberately tried to avoid characters like Anton Chigurh because he's a certain type of movie character that there are a lot of, and maybe we'll do someday here on the show in a top five, which is people who are just really violent and really crazy, basically sociopaths. So we tried to avoid that a little bit. I have a couple other things I sought with my list. What about you, Josh?
For me, it was instinctive, really emotional, and very personal. I think these are going to be interesting because what scares me might not scare either of you guys. And I also figured out that it was very much tied to things I saw as a kid and I still haven't recovered from. Every character on my list is that way, but two for sure I first encountered as a young, impressionable child.
Yeah, I think that applies to many of my picks as well. For me, it was also about not just picking characters who disgust you or kind of repulse you, not what I'd call everyday monsters. We saw some people on our Facebook page that posted people like Chad, Aaron Eckhart's character from In the Company of Men. Yes, I could see the argument that he's a monster, but I'm not sure he provokes that visceral reaction of fear that I was going for with my list. And the question I asked myself as I was forming my list was, if my wife wasn't there and I had to watch this movie on my couch in my basement all by myself, could I watch these films? Could I make it through seeing these characters? So that was my litmus test. Michael, how did you form your list and what's your number five?
I like that litmus test about the basement. You know, how would I feel about watching this alone in the basement? But I tended not to go for people with knives, you know, guns, although with one major exception, but it's really just more about characters that unsettle you, you know, and you do feel like would be unusually uncomfortable real life company.
Yeah.
You know, so and at the same time, I didn't want anybody I worked with at the Tribune. So, you know, they were off the list.
I also excluded Tribune personnel. So
good. My number five is the psychiatrist or psychologist played by Leonard Nimoy in the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I love it. To me, that's one of the slyest examples of somebody who's basically trying to suck the soul right out of you by a lot of soothing psychobabble and kind of comforting, feel-good, if it feels right, do it therapy. It's a wonderful, it's a really funny critique of the kind of new age nonsense that was really fermenting in the Bay Area in the late 70s when, when Philip Kaufman directed this great remake of Body Snatchers. And it's in a funny way, it's a minor character in this film, but it has always stuck with me. And I have to thank my colleague Christopher Borelli at the Tribune, because he's the one who jogged my memory on it. So.
Sounds like a great pick. Unfortunately, I've only seen the original. So
what the hell?
I'm
you
sorry.
With that and Barry Lyndon over here with Josh?
I've seen it. I can't even remember him being in it, though.
Well, those terrifying turtlenecks, for one thing. He's never seen without a really the worst turtleneck since they're the worst turtlenecks ever.
Josh, you're number five.
I went with Sadako and Ringu. I'm going to go with the 1998 Hideo Nakata original.
You're going Japanese here,
I'm
not
going
the
Japanese, not the Hollywood Ring films with Naomi Watts. The whole series revolves around a bizarre videotape that puts a lethal curse on those who watch it. Sadako in the original is played by, and I'm sure I'm getting this wrong, Rei Inno. I don't want to give too much away about who she is or what role she plays in the story. And it really, for me, doesn't even matter in terms of the scariness factor. It's all about the look here, the visuals.
Yeah.
She's got the long white robe, the black hair, super long, draped over her face. It's almost this, with just the black and white, it's like this binary, stark figure that just jumps right out at you. And in the cursed video, this is the image that always comes to mind when I think about her. In the cursed video, she comes out of a well in the forest slowly and kind of lurching.
That is really effective.
We got to get the lights on.
Oh, man.
It's not bright enough in here.
For some reason, though, it's ultimately the stillness of this character that haunts me, and the way she's often just standing there so that all you can do is let the dread sort of soak in on you. I think stillness is a technique that for some reason really terrifies me in horror movies. I'll get back to stillness more in my list later.
I think I may get to a pick that involves a lot of stillness as well. That's a great one. And to invert Michael's choice with Body Snatchers, this is a case where I haven't seen the original and only seen the remake. And Samara from The Ring was an honorable mention for me, mainly because of that well scene. So great pick. My number five is a movie that, Michael, you unfavorably compared the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men to, and it's maybe the film that I'd be safest to watch by myself alone in the basement because it's really more of a crime thriller than a horror movie. The character is Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs. The end scene with Jodie Foster and the night vision goggles, that would make me jump up and pop a light or two on. Certainly, that is legitimately scary. But really, with that character, what it is, it's the way Demme and Anthony Hopkins and the writer Ted Talley just do such a good job of making him a threat, a constant threat. Even when he's behind bars, even when he's in a glass cage, you don't feel safe talking to him or even watching him.
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
Closer, please. Closer.
So I would just be trying to avoid moving anywhere close to that cell. I'd keep at least a 50-yard distance. And I guess thinking about it, what is so scary about him, I guess it's largely that he may eat you. I have to confess that disturbs me and scares me a little bit.
There's the eating factor.
It's not just that he'll kill you or hurt you, but he's slowly going to eat you. You're going to suffer, and it's all very unnatural. So that is why Hannibal Lecter is my number five.
I might have to go with Buffalo Bill, though, actually.
There's
something about the charming factor of Lecter that makes you feel, and I know it's all part of the plot, makes you feel comfortable, but that kind of remains for me, whereas Buffalo Bill is just this wild card I want nothing to do with.
Yeah, Lecter scares me more, and I know some people will probably write in and mention Francis Dolaride from Red Dragon, another character in the Hannibal Lecter series, but for me, it's Lecter. Michael, you're number four.
My number four, I find more frightening than that character. I mean, I knew it was just a matter of statistical odds that somebody would pick Lecter, Hopkins' performance as Lecter. It's a performance in a film that really did put the whammy on a lot of people. I think Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth in Blue Velvet, to me, could really clean that guy's clock. And, I mean, even without the mysterious unnamed gas he's ingesting in some of the scenes in Blue Velvet, I think what Hopper does in that, when I think back to what the impact it had on me back in 86, I think, 1986, that kind of humor and horror fine line is something that actually Hopkins was treading a bit in Silence of the Lambs a few years later. And you almost get that. You get whiffs of that in something as recent as Heath Ledger's Joker in the by far the best of the three Dark Knight films. It's not easy to scare the hell out of an audience while getting the right kind of laugh. And that's what some of the most heinous behavior, well, and not all of it, because a lot of it's just genuinely horrifying and painful to watch. But what Hopper's doing in Blue Velvet to me is true terror.
Hey, you want to go for a ride?
No, thanks.
No, thanks. What does that mean?
I don't want to go.
Go where?
For a ride.
A ride. Now, that's a good idea. Okay, let's go. Let's go. Get your f***ing robe. Raymond! Come on, we're going to go for a joyride.
Joyride.
He's so good, and that's such a great film. It's actually in the Film Spotting Pantheon, so I couldn't include Frank Booth, but I will mention that
Could you put it in the Parthenon instead?
I could try to do that instead. Okay. I don't know if that would make a whole lot of sense, but going back to 2006, the Halloween edition of Film Spotting, then we did our top five scariest moments, scariest scenes in films, and my number five was a scene from Blue Velvet and Dennis Hopper as Frank Booth, because there is one moment in particular. It's the staircase scene where he just looks up. All he has to do is look up at Kyle MacLachlan, and that's enough to give me chills. So I'm with you on Frank Booth. Josh, your number four.
My number four is going to come from a film that maybe not a lot of people remember, but those who do, it will definitely have had an impact on, and I think they'll agree with me here, that the Skeksis in The Dark Crystal are terrifying characters. This 1982 family creature feature is The Muppets by way of Brothers Grimm. Jim Henson really took his Muppet artistry to an entirely new and darker level here. There isn't a human face to be found in the film. Now, the heroes are forest creatures called Gelflings, and they are almost human-like, but it's the villains, the Skeksis, who dominated my imagination when I first saw the film. They're kind of a bird-like race. They look like these giant, decrepit vultures. And in the story, they're dying and they need this crystal shard to restore their vitality. So there's a lot of these creatures, and I'm going to have to pick the creepiest one. For me, it's the one known as the Chamberlain. He's this weaselly, conniving figure, and he has this odd and insinuating whine that he does throughout the film. At one point, the other Skeksis tear the Chamberlain's elaborate robe off of him, and he's revealed to be this kind of bony, scrawny thing. He's about a third of the size that you would expect, judging by this big robe that he wears. And as a kid, it reminded me of those times I'd come across a dead bird that was kind of all bent and splayed out, except in this case, the bird still moves and talks. So when you're 8 or 9, Skeksis nightmares are no fun.
It's funny because The Dark Crystal is a movie I remember seeing in the theater when I was about 8 or 9, and you mentioned capturing your imagination. It didn't capture my imagination at all. I have no recollection of it.
And I've never seen it.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's too
bad. You have a little bit of a different appreciation for creatures that are
all things Muppets, perhaps.
Muppets, basically. You do appreciate that more than I do. My number four terrifying movie character is going to continue a little bit of a trend here. I started with my Hannibal Lecter pick. I guess you're getting an insight into my psyche. It's Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original film.
I'm going with
one of the classic horror movie villains. Faces, a lot of times in movies, in horror movies, are what terrify me. Just a face. And it doesn't even have to be a face that has a mask or anything really crazy about it. It can just be a look on a face. But with this character, Leatherface, even if I didn't know what his mask was made out of, I'd be scared just because there's something so ugly and repugnant about it. But then when you find out that it's made of human skin and he's a character who murders people and eats them, that again is something that just seems to really unnerve me.
I am sensing a theme here.
Yeah, that really bugs me. I don't want to be lunch. I guess I don't want to be lunch. I don't know how to phrase it.
You
want to
eat the lunch.
Way.
You want to eat the lunch.
His introduction scene too, speaking of scariest movie moments, the scene where we meet Leatherface for the first time. He opens the door and drags that girl in and hangs her on the hook. That is really, really terrifying.
Hideous, yeah.
And at that point, we haven't even met the rest of the family. So we only go up from there. Leatherface is my number four. That brings us to our number three terrifying movie characters. Michael?
I love Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, which is not a horror film, and it's not a conventional thriller, but it's full of completely unsettling wormy, eccentric. Oh, yeah.
And the character is Charlton Heston's accent. That's your number three.
It's just my, the character is just the way Charlton Heston keeps saying Susie. You know, he is not the most horrifying element of that. I actually think the most memorable supporting character, side character in that film, which is really just all great side characters, is Dennis Weaver's night hotel manager. Huh. It's a great, amazing. There's one shot in there, and largely this is just a testament to Welles's camera sense. And I mean, where the wind is howling, and this poor schlep is out there, hopelessly outmatched by this sadistic gang of biker thugs that's kidnapped Janet Leigh, and you know, you're just imagining the worst of what's going on. And this is 1958, so this is a wonderful period where they couldn't show everything yet, and you wouldn't want to see anymore because your mind is sort of racing with all these horrible possibilities. But Dennis Weaver is again sort of this pathetically funny figure who's just kind of standing up there like King Lear's fool in this howling wind, just hopelessly. I'm just a nightman. And somehow that kind of desperation to me is more frightening than anything in a conventional horror film. So Dennis Weaver, ladies and gentlemen.
An inspired pick there, Michael. Josh, you're number three.
I'm going to go back to my childhood, and this would be the clown in Poltergeist.
I wondered if someone would bring it up. That's a scary scene.
Clowns are scary enough, right? And then Poltergeist has to go and up the ante. This is also from 1982, same year as The Dark Crystal, interestingly enough.
What happened in 1982 to you, Josh?
Let's investigate.
Rough year
on the next
me,
film
apparently.
Spotting.
There are so many things wrong with this bedtime scene. It's where Robbie is going to bed with his sister next to him, which should provide some comfort, but for some reason it
wouldn't
doesn't.
For me.
They've got the toys scattered about. And the one thing I wonder is, why is this clown doll so big? It's like between the size of a regular doll and a
so
small
person. So it's scary,
person.
Josh. So it's scary.
Yeah, but why do that? And the other thing, why is it placed in the chair? So it's sitting at the foot of his bed, looking directly at him.
Who would do that?
Does that?
It's like the only thing missing in that bedroom is the dummy that Anthony Hopkins was using in the movie Magic.
Right.
The ventriloquist dummy.
Oh, I remember being terrified by that Saturday morning cartoon, that commercial, I should say. I saw that. I remember that. It was horrifying for Magic.
Well, I love the touch in Poltergeist where Robbie tries to throw the blanket over the clown from bed, and it hits those jingling bells, which become notes of terror. And then he misses with the blanket. But, of course, he doesn't get out of the bed because he's not leaving that bed for anything. And the attack itself, of course, is terrifying precisely because the clown drags him where? Under the bed. The only thing that saves me from cardiac arrest is the clown's arms. How they kind of get longer and wrap up. I always found that to be a little silly. And
it's cartoonish.
I could take a breath there and let it go.
That's a great pick. And it gives me a chance to mention one of my honorable mentions from a horrible film. Really not a good movie at all, but the character obviously very memorable. It's Poltergeist 2 and the character of Kane, the older man in the black suit who comes to their door.
I don't remember him.
I've never seen the sequel.
It's really not worth seeing, but just do a Google search. YouTube Kane and Poltergeist 2. It doesn't matter if it's daylight or not. You'll get scared. I'm telling you right now. It's actually an honorable mention for me. My number three goes back to what we've spent most of this show discussing, The Shining, and it is the Grady twins. Though, actually, in the film, if you remember Ullman's line of dialogue, they're not really supposed to be twins. They're
8
years old and 10.
Eight
exactly,
ten.
Michael. But they're played by twins in real life, and most people do refer to them as the Grady twins. So that's what I'm going with as well. If you take out the music, this is something I was very aware of as I watched the film this time, that score by Wendy Carlos and Rachel Elkin, if you took that out, I don't know how scary The Shining would be, because the music anticipates a lot of the big fright moments in the movie. But Danny coming around that corner on his big wheel, the classic shot from The Shining, probably the most classic shot anyway, and seeing those twins with the music, that really gets my heart racing. And I think it's obviously the surprise factor, partly. Every time you see them, it's a surprise that they just appear. And this gets back to your stillness line there, Josh, because they are so still. If you just take them at face value, there's nothing really scary about two twins in dresses. They look a little weird, maybe, but otherwise they're just standing there. It's something about the combination of the music and the look on Danny's face and the close-ups and just the heightened tension of that moment. Actually, what Kubrick does in that scene in the hallway is he cuts to Danny and then he keeps cutting back to them, and every time he cuts back he's closer to them. Mm-hmm. And that really gets the tension mounted there in that scene.
Hello, Danny. Come and play with us.
this, Daddy. Forever and ever and ever.
Right away, the Grady twins popped into my head when I thought about terrifying movie characters. Had to make my list. Michael, you're number two.
That's a good one. This is not anybody's idea of a major movie character, but I love... My number two is the movie projectionist and movie buff, Bob Vaughn, played by Charles Fleischer in David Fincher's film Zodiac.
Wow.
Remember the scene?
I do. How could you forget?
Jake Gyllenhaal's visiting this guy, trying to get this, you know, this whole thing about... He holds the clue to the 1932 film, The Most Dangerous Game, and this somehow will help fill in this piece of the puzzle that never quite gets solved, which is the genius of the film. And the whole scene, A, it's one of the best sequences Fincher's ever staged, but Fleischer's, the kind of way he's photographed, and the whole thing is shot through with horrible dread and just imminent danger that never quite gets fulfilled, but it's really kind of a great little portrait in this movie obsessive, and it to me it's like a cautionary tale in that this is what you turn into if you become a little bit too much of a movie buff. And this is Fleischer's, you know, portrait of this guy who just clearly all he lives for is what he can collect in his basement. And Gyllenhaal, who I don't think is really frankly much of an actor, is acting straight from his gut in this scene because everything else about the scene is just terrifically effective, and I love it. It's a great little cameo.
I thought at first when you were going with film projectionist, you were maybe thinking of Mark Lewis in Peeping Tom.
That's what I thought too.
Alan Pressburger, who's also pretty scary, and that's a scary movie. But I'm going to confirm everything you're saying about that scene. My top five scariest scenes, that scene in Zodiac was my number two. I'm right there with you.
Wow.
Right there with you.
It's the defining scene for Zodiac. Easily its most terrifying. My number two is Count Orlok. I'm going all the way back to Nosferatu. How many movie vampires have we had? I mean, far too many, probably. Yet none of them have ever looked like Max Schreck in F.W. Murnau's 1922 silent take on the Dracula legend. He's got the bald head, which emphasizes the paleness, this unearthly paleness, the wild eyebrows and the pointy ears, the elongated fingers and nails. This is hardly the dashing Count Dracula that we often get. He's far more creaturely. He's almost alien-like, really. And the stillness comes into play with Orlok again. Even when he's moving, his arms kind of hang straight down to his sides, and he slowly walks forward without using them at all and just emphasizes them as weapons, perhaps. I don't know. Something about that just disturbs me. This really was a high point of German expressionism. And you think of the iconic image of Orlok coming up the stairs, that shadow. I mean, shadows are used so beautifully throughout this film. Now, you'd think an old movie like this couldn't frighten, say, yeah, you're not really scared of that movie, are you? But when I think of that face and that image, it gives you that chill. And there's something about the unique aura of the movie that adds to its power because it's unlike anything we get now or have gotten for a long time. Somehow that makes it scarier.
I'm with you. In fact, vampires often scare me in movies, though I didn't pick one for this list. But Nosferatu the Vampire, the Herzog film with Klaus Kinski, is one I definitely considered because Kinski on his own is terrifying. But then you put him in that vampire makeup and give him those eyes, and that's enough to really scare me. So great pick. My number two is a character who, kind of like the twins in The Shining, is menacing and very frightening, but doesn't really have anything that makes him scary in a conventional kind of way. He's not like Leatherface or Jason. He's just a guy with long salt and pepper hair who makes kind of goofy faces, but he scares the hell out of me. And it's Bob from Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, the David Lynch film that came after the series, but is more like a prequel or sets up the Twin Peaks series that was on ABC. I don't know what it is about him that scares me so much. It's, I guess, the way he appears hiding behind things all the time. He's in Laura's room. In the TV series, he's hiding behind a couch. And it gives you the sense that he could be lurking in your room, hiding in a corner, or he could be behind the couch in your living room, all of a sudden appearing. And actually, when I was in college, my sophomore year, my roommate, Kevin, we had bunk beds, you know, college standard dorm. When we were going to bed, I'd get in bed first. And then before he got in his top bunk, he would often perch just over the couch in a Bob position. And he would wait for me to notice that something was off in the room and open my eyes and see him basically right above me in a Bob pose waiting to scare the hell out of me. That's he thought that was fun, and it was not fun.
Where's his radio show?
He's an actor, as you might imagine, and a fine drama professor now. But actually, I think too with Bob, it's just something about what he does embody. If you watch the series, if you watch the Fire Walk With Me film, he is in some ways this character who seems to embody evil. That he's someone that you welcome in with all your weaknesses and all your frailties. You could end up being possessed by Bob. And that's not a place you want to be. So that's my number two. That brings us to our number one most terrifying movie character, Michael.
Lucille Ball in Mame. No.
Yikes.
No, just not quite. I try to avoid a really famous example for this number one slot, but I in the end, I had to go with Norman Bates, as played by Anthony Perkins in Psycho, because of all it has wrought in its wake, all these cheap imitators and, you know, much less creative and inventively imagined serial killers since. And I guess Norman Bates is a serial killer, and so therefore he's a relatively early, 1960, not so early in film history, but a relatively early major in the real shock era of cinema. That's an early example of a movie that just was notorious at the time, and people thought it was cheap and offensive and it went too far, and how could even a guy like Hitchcock with a reputation put out something like that? Well, this is a film like Kubrick's The Shining, that the reputation has just grown every decade, and I find that film and that performance profoundly upsetting and unsettling. And I think the image of Norman Bates in that cell with the eyes down and that classic what would become
in the
Kubrick phase, where you have that subliminal moment of superimposition where you have the skull, the mummy, you know, kind of the skull of the dead mother, you know, smiling through. Just keeps smiling through. And then the dredging the car up, Marion Crane's car. That's a great last 5-10 seconds. That, I mean, everything comes together with Bernard Herrmann's final chords of the score. And his next film, Hitchcock's film that followed up, The Birds, is very scary, very frightening in another way, and has sort of, in a completely different way, has an ending that is just as tantalizing and unresolved, you know, where you just see that car full of survivors driving off very slowly because the birds have for some reason decided not to attack that time. That's poetry. I mean, that's real art. That's real art.
They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
That closing scene of Psycho is amazing, that closing shot, and the thing that amplifies it is just that twisted little smile on his face. Yep. It just somehow makes it all that more unnerving. Great pick.
Yeah, that was an honorable mention for me. Easily could have broken into the top five. For my number one, though, I'm going with a relatively recent film and a somewhat minor character in terms of screen time. It's Tomas in the Orphanage. This is a 2007 Spanish film from director Juan Antonio Bayona. It's about a woman. She's a wife and a mother who reopens the orphanage where she grew up, and she's hoping to refurbish it and bring new kids there. But then weird things start to happen. One of these is the fact that her 7-year-old son, Simon, claims to have an imaginary friend named Tomas. And he draws this friend as a child with a sack over his head. That's creepy enough. But then this baghead kid makes an actual appearance in the film. And I just about lost it when this happened. And it's not even in this real spooky, I don't want to give it away, but it's not like, you know, in a dark tunnel or something when he does appear. But when he does, yeah, it's really rough. Now, obviously, there's something about the fact that it's a kid here. And we do learn some more about Tomas that makes him more of a horrifying figure. But I'm going to go back to that silence and the stillness that is used here, because when we see him, he's just sort of standing there. I think what this technique does is it puts the ball in the audience's court, so we're being forced to respond in some way. And in these instances, all we have to offer is fear, and it certainly works here with Tomas. For months after this movie came out, and I was a grown man at this point, whenever I woke up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water or whatever, I always feared that this kid would be standing there.
Wow.
I was like Robbie in Poltergeist. I did a lot of holding it for a while.
I bet. I love that pick. And I do have to mention, to show how I'm right there with you, that top five list from episode 233 of the show, Scariest Scenes, just ahead of Zodiac, was a scene from The Orphanage.
Yeah.
That's how scary that film
is
for me. It's not actually.
Seance is fantastic.
That's it. I think it's the seance, not actually the one you're mentioning where we see Tomas. It's the scene near the end of the film that just destroys me.
Okay,
meet some other characters.
And the seance comes quite early, right?
Oh, okay. Then I'm thinking of a different sequence, but there's one at the end of the movie where they're playing a children's game. That's the one.
Yeah,
That's the one that kills me in The Orphanage. So, great pick, and I love the fact that here on our Halloween show, we've got 15 unique movie characters. There was no overlap at all, and like you, Michael, I love to try to come up with more inspired creative picks, but sometimes you just have to go with the originals, the ones that really scared you from a very young age.
And Lucille Ball and Mame.
Exactly. Yeah. Here, though, the power of Christ compels me to pick Regan McNeil / Satan as my number one
really
scariest movie character. And it's funny because I hear that tone in your voice, Michael, like she's really not that scary.
No, I don't love the film.
Oh, see, I like the film a lot.
And by the way, I'm not that crazy about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I've heard that. Somehow
really?
I've heard
kidding
that,
me?
Actually. But I said it with Leatherface. It's something for me mostly about faces that scare me. And the eyes, the yellow eyes of Regan as she becomes possessed, that deteriorating face, her voice, the Mercedes McCambridge voice, but also her deviousness as a character. I always think of the scene where I believe she's talking to Father Maron and she starts talking like Father Maron's mom, I think, and saying these really horrible, vile things. That's really scary. I was pulling a clip today for this top five, and I got scared in broad daylight just looking at scenes and looking at Regan's face from The Exorcist. I think there's, too, something about, as ridiculous as this may sound, something about The Exorcist that really scares me just in it's supposedly being based on a true story and all these real life exorcisms we hear about. There's something about that. If there's any shred of truth to stories like The Exorcist at all, then it suggests that there's a real evil in this world that I don't fundamentally buy into. Mm. But then movies like this make me question that a little bit, and that scares me.
I'm a friend of your mother's. I'd like to help you.
You might loosen the straps.
I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Regan.
I'm not Regan.
I see. Well, then let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
If you're the devil, why not make the straps disappear?
That's much too vulgar a display of power, Karras.
Where's Regan?
In here with us.
Show me Regan and I'll loosen one of the straps.
Can you help an old altar boy, Father?
Your mother's in here with us, Karras. Would you like to leave a message? I see that she gets it.
See, the Skuxies didn't affect you. I didn't really get affected by Linda Blair when I saw this movie.
It
seems to me to be trying so hard to scare you. And the
Friedkin's
overall,
not subtle.
Well, no, and I think, you know, obviously, like I said at the very beginning, it's a very personal thing, and the effects that are used there will terrify one person, whereas to me, it was just so apparent that I never really got caught up in it.
Yeah, for me, it really is all about that face. So The Exorcist is my number one terrifying movie character. Also, the demon that we meet early in the film, just that one image we see of the demon, that's scary as well. But let's get to a few honorable mentions. Any other picks, Michael, that you thought of that just missed your cut?
One that just missed the cut for me is based on your criteria of, like, would you want to be in the basement watching this or with this character? Hal 9000 from 2001. Let's stick with the Kubrick. You know, he's a guy that would really find a way to prevent you from leaving that basement.
Indeed.
You know, just either through that eerie sense of calm reason in the voice or just a technological superiority, which is not hard for me because I'm a guy who still can't figure out his 8-track tape player. So, I love that character. I think that's Kubrick's last great film. I think he made some very, very strong work since then, but that was the last great one.
What are you doing, Dave? Josh, your honorable mentions?
Well, I thought about Large Marge in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but
that
I realized
scary.
That's a very frightening moment.
I had grown out of it. If I were going to be honest, and these were going to be characters that still terrified me when I watched it again recently, not so scary. Pale Man in Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, that is quite a freaky figure. The others have been mentioned. Leatherface, Norman Bates, Buffalo Bill, and the twins from The Shining.
Well, I'm only going to mention two more, as I've said a couple, and there are so many more we could get to. I can't wait to get some of the feedback on these picks because, as you said, Josh, at the beginning, it's very personal what scares you. So those emails should be good. But the other two I'll mention, Jaws. I have to give some credit to Jaws as a movie character because after seeing Jaws, I remember going for a fairly extended period of time where I wouldn't sleep with my legs extended in my bed. I feared somehow that if my feet were down at the end of my bed, a Jaws-like creature would be able to eat
upper
my
half
feet,
of the bed, safe.
As if he was on dry
lower
land
half,
in my
yeah.
house. This is how irrational these kind of fears are. Nevertheless, Jaws scared me. I also, for the longest time, for at least a year or two when I was a kid, I wouldn't go into the deep end of a pool because I thought about sharks. I thought about Jaws being in the water. So got to give some love to Jaws there. And also, I'll mention, I'm going to butcher the name. I believe it's Aihe Shina. That is the character from Takeshi Miike's Audition, who's very scary. And you want to talk about a scene that will really disturb you. She actually might be more terrifying in some ways than Leatherface, but just an honorable mention for me. So those are our top five terrifying characters. Send us your spooky picks or any other comments about the show to feedback at filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, the new drama Keep the Lights On. The Sessions with John Hawkes opens, and Pusher, this is a remake of the Nicholas Winding Refn 1996 Danish film, and that series, considering how much I love Drive and some of Refn's other work, I do at some point need to catch up with the Pusher series and this new film as well. Out in wide release, Silent Hill Revelation 3D. Fun Size, this is basically, I've seen the trailer, this is a ripoff of Adventures in Babysitting, right?
It looked similar.
And that's blasphemy for me because that's another classic from my youth. Chasing Maverick, starring Gerard Butler, and Cloud Atlas, the new film starring Tom Hanks and a huge ensemble cast directed by the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer. Next week on the show, we will review Cloud Atlas. We'll also get to the second film in our Blaxploitation marathon. They could have just called the film Michael Phillips. Instead, they called it Superfly. We'll also...
I thought you were just going to call it Trouble Man.
Yeah, there you go. We'll also do a top five. We do them every week here on the show. We just don't know what the top five is going to be quite yet. We might go something like multiple roles in one movie, an actor like Tom Hanks in Cloud Atlas who plays
that
multiple characters. Also, maybe act of kindness movies. We could also just pay tribute to Tom Hanks and do our favorite Tom Hanks scenes.
Tom Hanks
so
scenes, yeah.
We look forward to some of your thoughts on that. You can always email us feedback at filmspotting.net.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Little Legend. Learn more at littlelegend.us.
Of course, we have to say thanks to our regular monthly contributor, Michael Phillips. So great to have you here, as always. That was a really fun show. Hope you had a good time.
I did. Thank you, guys.
Where can our listeners find Michael Phillips on the internet?
You can find me at chicagotribune.com/movies.
For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.